You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us this afternoon for our event where we're going to launch the eighth paper in our series, Turkey Project Policy Paper Series. I'm Kemal Kirişçi, the TÜSİAD Senior Fellow and the Director of the Turkey Program. And we will have Nora Fisher, who is the author of our paper, who will present her views on it. As I am sure you're well aware, not a day goes by without the challenges in and around Turkey chasing each other. There's a lot to talk about, and what this paper is doing is looking at the way in which two forces, political forces, appear to be competing with each other in Turkey, in its domestic politics as well as its foreign policy, the one driven by populism versus the actual reality of what is unfolding in the region. I had always thought that one day Turkey was going to become a boring place and that I could move on to greener grass and enjoy life a little bit. But today I think you're going to hear from Nora as well as the panel that neither Turkey nor Turkey's neighborhood is about to become boring. I hope, nevertheless, it does become one day before it's too late for me. The way we're going to proceed is that Nora is going to reflect on the paper for 12, 15 minutes. And Nora is a very good friend and a fellow of the Transatlantic Academy within the German Marshall Fund, of which I too was a fellow a few years back. She has her PhD from Oxford, but she's a local girl, if you wish, received her first degree from Georgetown, as well as her master's right from next door, Sais John Hopkins. She has published extensively, short op-eds as well as major publications, and I think you're going to look forward to hearing her. Soner Çağaptay, who will be responding to Nora's paper, is, I'm sure, a name that you're very familiar with. He's the Bayer Family Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Studies, and he too runs a Turkey program the way I do. He is very prolific. It's very difficult to keep up with what he's writing, but especially a very recent piece of his looking at the Ottoman Empire and the current Turkey and the way the current Turkey wants to be shaped by the Turkish president is really worth a quick read. But he's also the author of a recent book called The Rise of Turkey, 21st Century's First Muslim Power. I don't know if he still feels that it's a power, but it's a Muslim one, all right. And then Alan Makowski, he doesn't like when I say that he's an old hand on his topics. I get grilled for it. But then we're in the same boat, I suppose. Alan has had an interest in Turkey and has been working on Turkey for a long time, partly for the State Department at one point, partly for the House of Representatives as a staffer, and now he's a fellow at the Center for American Progress. It's great to have you, Alan, but don't grill me, please, for the word I used. Kadir Üstün is a good friend, and he's he's the executive director of SETA, a Turkish think tank that also has its offices here. He is the editor of a journal called Insight Turkey, and I think the title says a lot about the journal itself. I would also recommend it as a regular publication that you might consider following closely. Kadir, too, is a prolific publisher. You can reach his publications on SETA's website, and has recently received his PhD from Columbia University. It's been a while? Okay.
Getting old.
I'm the only one who doesn't have a PhD from the United States. I think, Nora, it's time to turn the floor to you, and we're looking forward to your points.
Great. Well, thank you so much for inviting me to write the paper, to all of you for joining us today, and to this distinguished panel for so graciously being willing to comment on my work. I think we're all here because Turkey is a fascinating and crucial country for U.S. Foreign policy towards the Middle East, towards Europe. And if this means the stakes are quite high in any debate about Turkey, it also means that Turkey watchers, like ourselves, tend to become quite obsessed with a lot of the details, which can sometimes mean that we lose sight of the bigger picture and broader trends in which Turkey is a part of. And so I thought with this paper that I would take as my starting point a bigger pattern of which I think Turkey offers a very good case study, and that is of the growing power of populism in politics today and the implications of this heightened style of populist politics for foreign policy making. Because I think it's a challenge not just for Turkey, but for the United States, for France, for Hungary, for Russia. And it's really a fascinating turn. What is populism? It's a style of politics in which an established or an aspiring leader claims to represent the people, the ordinary guy on the street, the supposed majority, in order to gain and consolidate power. But they frame this project as a truth-telling mission. They're going to show those cynical national elites, if it's a domestic politician trying to obtain power, or that cynical international community, if it's an incumbent politician on a national scene. Even though their missions, you know, this truth-telling mission may differ in content, so the way Putin does it will differ from the way that Victor Chavez did it in Venezuela. But they use very similar techniques. And one of those techniques or sort of strategies is to use very dramatic imagery but clear language in order to scapegoat others, to draw a clear distinction between us and them. And in the rich world, this means that populists tend to point to poor migrants as the source of the country's problems. In the developing world, it often means that populists point to Western imperialists and their nefarious plans, you know, to continue ruling the world as the source of the country's problems. But it can lead to illiberal policies or policy proposals when you frame things in this way. So we certainly see this in, you know, gay bashing in Putin's Russia, in Donald Trump's anti-Muslim stands. And all of this, regardless of, you know, normatively how you feel about the content of these platforms, all of this is problematic for foreign policy making. Because good foreign policy requires embracing the gray areas. It requires being able to make compromises, as well as being able to do, you know, fabulous grandstands. It requires being able to build and sustain coalitions, and it requires recognizing in a dispassionate way that your rival in one arena might be your partner in another arena. So I think Thomas Friedman really captured the gap here between the logic of domestic populism and the logic of foreign policy making when he said that it's like playing by the rules of Go Fish. Some of you might remember that from college dorm days. It's like playing high-stakes poker with the rules of Go Fish. And it is this gap between sort of a simplifying, polarizing domestic rhetoric on one hand and the complexities of foreign policy on the other that is a trap, I believe, Turkey has fallen into, especially in the past 2 years. But what I do in the paper, and I hope that all of you will take a copy and read it, you know, spend, you know, I know you have nothing better to do this evening than to kick back with a nice cup of tea or glass of wine and read my paper. But, I mean, in a nutshell, I basically trace the relationship between domestic populism and geopolitical imperative in Turkey since the ruling Justice and Development Party came to power in 2002. And I show that there have been three basic periods, one from 2002 to roughly 2007, 2008, in which domestic populism was really aimed at discrediting and displacing the then elite and the then political establishment, using a democratizing language and narrative, pursuing liberalizing policies, and this was accompanied by the EU accession process, of course. So in that period, domestic populism and geopolitical orientation were both pro-Western, in effect. They went hand in hand. Then, from 2008 to roughly 2012, Turkey had its sort of so-called neo-Ottoman turn. And this was framed as added value to international audiences, in that Turkey was pursuing a sort of manifest destiny in the former Ottoman geography, in the Middle East, the Balkans, the Caucasus. Although we were told that we shouldn't read this as an either-or proposition and that Turkey's heightened influence in its regions was going to benefit its relationships with the EU and NATO, for example, especially towards the end of that period, that language and especially its kind of domestic expressions started to take on a more anti-Western thrust. And of course, it depends on where you sit in the West or among the West allies. From a U.S. perspective, one sort of consequence of this neo-Ottoman turn during this period was that relations with Israel increasingly became grist to the mill of domestic populism, and that created a dilemma for Washington needing to balance its close ties with allies in Israel and allies in Turkey. So there you see the populism-realism gap starting to create some tensions in Turkey's relations with the West. Then things became really much more intense after 2013, because this was a period when Turkey entered an electoral cycle of what looked to be three, turned out to be four elections, municipal, presidential, and then two national elections between 2013 and 2015. And during this time, the sort of domestic populist language that involved, you know, invoking anti-Western conspiracies and pinning these on the domestic opposition, and I might add that the domestic opposition also very much embraced a populist style and modes of response. So it was, you know, fighting fire with fire and the such a very polarized atmosphere. This actually really started to push against the grain of Turkey's regional sort of interest, because this was a time period when the Middle East was becoming increasingly more complicated. You had the intensification of crisis in Syria, of course. You had the emergence of ISIS. You had a very dynamic developments on the ground vis-a-vis the transnational Kurdish question. And these were all areas where that are vital to Turkey's national interests, but because of the focus on the domestic agenda and this and the use of this populist calculus at home, Turkey wasn't really able to address these questions maybe to the extent that it would have been in both its interest and that of its Western allies. So at the end of this electoral cycle in November, 2015, in principle, there should be a moment to reset, right? To repivot, to square the circle so that the tone and substance of domestic rhetoric and policies matches up more with this new geopolitical environment in which there's very clear convergent interests between Turkey and its Western partners in the EU and the US. In order for that to happen, and I developed this again in the paper, I think there's three areas that, three sort of domestic issues that were let out of Pandora's box, as it were, that somehow need to be resolved and put back, and that they're going to be the three big challenges. We can talk about them more perhaps in the discussion or afterwards in the Q&A, but just to name them briefly, there's the conflict between quote-unquote secularists and quote-unquote Islamists. I've never been a fan of those terms because in Turkey, like everywhere else, people have multiple intersecting and fluid identities. But one consequence of populism is that they tend to harden. And so I think one of the casualties of the past few years in terms of the populist playing field has been there was a moment of fluidity maybe in the mid-2000s when there was a chance to really negotiate a post-Kemalist secular, post-Islamist kind of new social contract, new social consensus. And I feel like that's been, that window may have closed over the past few years. There's a conflict that has been quite latent for centuries now, actually, but it does, the specter of sectarianism in Turkey is starting to rise, especially in the context of the region, and that we see in the increasing tensions between Sunnis and Alevis that have also been exacerbated by the populism of recent years. We can talk about more about how to address that and what the implications are also for U.S. Policies towards the region. Then there is, of course, the Kurdish-Turkish conflict. And that's the most immediate and the most intractable. And that, too, I mean, of course, the reason why the peace process has run aground isn't only domestic populism, but that's certainly one important contributing factor. That has a lot of implications for Turkey. It has a lot of implications for U.S. policy towards the region because of the transnational nature of the Kurdish question. We see this most recently this past week in Geneva when the U.S. found itself caught between its allies on the ground in Syria, the Kurdish YPG forces in Syria, and its allies in Turkey who refused to have the Kurds come to sit at the bargaining table. So, you know, the U.S. has a real kind of dilemma there in terms of how it's going to address both its regional concerns and its bilateral relationship vis-a-vis the Kurdish question. There's a number of other arenas that, again, we can discuss more in the Q&A. On balance, am I optimistic that this potential window for closing the gap between populism and realism can come to pass? Not particularly, and it's not because I don't love Turkey, because I do, but I do think that there's been some quite fundamental changes on the Turkish political scene in the past decade. One of them has to do with the way foreign policy is conducted. It has to do with basically the privileging of a very kind of dramatic and bold and brinksmanship-oriented style of domestic policymaking on the foreign policy level as well. And this is because, you know, previously foreign policy was the domain of kind of bureaucratic elites, the military, with the displacement of these cadres in the past decade, that role has been increasingly taken up by the Turkish leadership proper, by President Erdogan. He is a consummate domestic politician. He is not known for bringing to bear those compromise brokering, non-polarizing, you know, willingness to, you know, work with ambiguity sort of dimensions that one needs to be able to leverage to be effective in the foreign policy arena. So, you know, he's made some unnecessary enemies, Russia's Putin. He's backed Turkey into some corners. this is you know, this is a function not just of his personality, but also of the increasing role that domestic politicians will have to play in foreign policy making in Turkey in the future. A second reason I'm a bit ambivalent is I think there's been some real ideological shift over the past decade. The center in Turkey, the sort of the de facto steady state, used to really involve a pro-Western thread and strand, along with an ambivalent strand set of sentiment towards the West. I think the populism of the past decade has really pulled the pendulum more to the nationalist, Islamist, and anti-Western right. And that's kind of the new normal in terms of the political grammar. So that's going to be a challenge to work with in the future. Western policymakers can't simply assume that everything's going to fix itself and Turkey will come back to a staunchly pro-Western sort of ethos and position. Last but not least, there's the challenges of spillover from an extraordinarily volatile region. Certainly, these challenges are not Turkey's fault, it's you know, a very, very complex situation. Unfortunately, the history books are filled with political leaders and movements that thought that they could mobilize populist passions, ethno-religious passions, and control them towards their own, you know, agendas as leaders, as parties, in highly volatile geopolitical context like we have in the Middle East right now. The history books show that is rarely the case, and that these passions take on a life of their own. And we're already seeing this happening vis-a-vis the Turkish Kurdish conflict. It could, as I alluded to, it could bleed into sort of some sectarian tensions in Turkey. What to do about this? I think we have to be realistic and pursue concrete outcomes and joint solutions in areas of clear common interest in the short term. And then in the medium and longer term, we really need to recognize that if we live in a post-American Middle East, as Foreign Affairs suggested in its, I think, November-December edition, that a post-American Middle East cannot be a Middle East in which the United States is complacent, but where we have to be creative and where we have to be engaged, maybe not at the in the same ways that we used to in the past, but we really need to reach out to broad sectors at the civil society level, to this new generation of bureaucrats and young leaders in Turkey, from the ruling party, from the opposition, and establish dialogues and institutional mechanisms to sustain bilateral relations in increasingly uncertain times.
Well, thanks, Nora. Especially thanks for having managed to squeeze in such a rich and nuanced assessment of what's going on in Turkey within a bigger picture in a very limited time. I'm sure there'll be occasions to go into details. I think we're very fortunate that Soner will be responding. Soner also tries to look at that bigger picture, and we're looking forward to hearing your perspective on this.
Sure. Thank you, Kemal, and thank you for your nice words about my book. I think I'm holding off with the idea of writing the sequel for now. So it's still The Rise of Turkey. I wanted to start, of course, by commending Nora, you, and complimenting you on this study. I think this is one of the best studies on foreign policy I've read in a very long time. You do a masterful job of bringing what is generally taught to be two separate pieces, domestic politics and foreign policy in Turkey, and showing the interaction, and not just what most traditionalists would do, showing how domestic politics influences foreign policy, but directly showing to us as well how foreign policy is increasingly shaping Turkish domestic politics, whether it's the Kurdish issue or the fallout of the Syrian conflict in terms of the polarization, the polarized landscape of the country. So I think it's a great study, and I would also recommend this as your bedtime reading tonight. Mm-hmm. So if you have difficulty falling asleep and you don't do yoga, this will be very useful. So I wanted to take on a couple of the points you've raised, one of which is the gap between idealism and realism, which I think has existed and still does in Turkey's foreign policy. And I'll take a slightly different angle at it. And I think the gap could also be seen as a gap that's whereby Turkey's foreign policy did indeed succeed in the last decade to make Turkey a standalone, at most times, standalone regional power with significant amount of clout. So in this regard, I think the test of the foreign policy was the Arab Spring, specifically when it became a war at Turkey's doorstep in Syria. That's where I think Turkish foreign policy elites have failed to react to the developments which put forward a number of challenges. I think the realist and populist strains in foreign policy, the slight attack I want to take a look at this would be say that at times Turkish foreign policy in the Middle East has been and is idealist, and at times it has been and is ideological, and sometimes it's both. So it's idealist because it really wants to do good, and I think this is very sincere, and in this regard, it's not guided by realistic aspirations. It wants to do good for the people of the region. And I think part of that is, of course, driven by previously foreign minister, now prime minister, Davutoğlu's own political philosophy, which you can find in his writings. And part of it is the neo-Ottomanist rhetoric. I think Turkey's idealism is often couched in its neo-Ottomanist rhetoric. The Ottomans were benevolent, absolutely. They were more progressive compared to their contemporaries. They invented religious tolerance when the concept did not exist to the east and south of Iran or to the west in Christian Europe. It was not only a tolerant society, it was a welcoming society. You had Spanish Jews and Hungarian Protestants and various other groups who had the kind of existence that they could not have anywhere else. And I think this is carried into the presence that the Ottoman tolerance can now be a model for the region. Turkey can reestablish this sort of an order carrying Ottoman legacy. But as all revivalist movements, I think Ottoman revivalism is at least in part imagined. And while the Ottomans were tolerant for their contemporaries, the Ottoman system would not be considered liberal for today. So there is one gap, I think, in terms of the idealist take of Turkish foreign policy and the reality that it faces. Another tension, I think, is that, as you've again masterfully raised, is the ideological aspect of the foreign policy, in the sense that it's, maybe the better word is partisan, that Turkey has often, or the foreign policy elites in Ankara have often failed to build bridges with various actors in a given country in the Middle East, oftentimes siding with just one actor. And that actor usually is the Muslim Brotherhood Party, as you've raised, in Egypt, in Syria, in Libya. The issue with putting all your money behind one horse in foreign policy is that if that horse wins, you win big. The problem is that if that horse loses, you lose everything. And I think the counterpart of Turkey's foreign policy doctrine in the region is Iran, which, in my view, bets money on all horses. So it always wins, small or big, but ultimately gets something out of it. So Turkey has been mostly and singularly aligned behind Muslim Brotherhood in the region, so it therefore failed to have clout. Though first rising in Egypt and Libya and elsewhere, it's been isolated in those countries across the spectrum of the Arab world. But the most significant, of course, case of, I think, decline of Turkish power since the beginning of the Arab Spring is in Syria. Not only the gap between idealism and the partisan attack has left Turkey sometimes unable to respond to developments on the field, but also I think Turkey has been unable to react to the entry of new actors into the field, Iran and then Russia. What was a pro-democracy uprising in Syria turned into a pro-democracy rebellion, which then morphed into a jihadist state, and Turkey's foreign policy is still supporting a pro-democracy uprising. So it needs to move forward two generations, at least, in terms of accepting the reality that Unfortunately, that's not the case in Syria anymore, and that's not where Syria is heading. And I think Iran's, of course, entry into Syria, a country with significant proxies, intelligence assets, and regional allies that Turkey lacks in Syria and in the region, and Russia's entry into the theater, a country that has a nuclear arsenal, veto power at the UN. Again, none of these tools are in Ankara's hands, has really undermined Turkey's foreign policy. So I think that's where the partisan or the ideological aspect of it has left Turkey with some challenges. The entry of Russia, I think, is very significant, and I'm really glad that you raised that also in this great paper. I would actually say that Turkey's foreign policy in Syria and the Middle East, it could be called as BPI, and I'm just making this up now, API, so before the plane incident and after the plane incident. Everything has changed after the plane incident, and nothing will be the same. Russia's entry as an antagonistic force against Turkey clearly is going to undermine Turkey's further aspirations, undercut Turkey's efforts to oust Assad, as well as force Turkey to pull back to its traditional allies. Everybody in Ankara knows, including President Erdogan, that the reason why Putin did not treat Turkey after the plane incident the way he treated Georgia or Ukraine is because Turkey is in NATO. I think NATO's value in Turkey has gone up significantly, ergo the value of the U.S. So that bodes well, I think, Kemal, and I hope that my other panelists will disagree with me on some of these issues. That maybe not on this one. that I think you're going to see a pivot of Turkey both to NATO and U.S., a stronger alliance. So in the long term, in terms of Turkey's foreign policy trajectory, I think after the plane incident, API is a good period in terms of Turkish foreign policy. It suggests a general alignment of Turkish, U.S., and NATO interests in the region. But there are challenges at home, and these are some of the challenges that you raised that I want to end up with. And maybe I'll take the point you raised and take it one step further in terms of how Syria, a foreign policy issue, in my view, is affecting Turkish domestic politics in ways that we could not have imagined only a couple of years ago. So in the analytical community here, when we had discussions in the U.S. government and elsewhere, but on media, I think one of the most frequent questions that we would get is, you know, whether the refugee issue would impact Turkey and how it would so and how we can prevent this from happening. And I think Turkey has done so far a really good job of handling the refugee crisis. It has 2.5 million refugees. That's the migration crisis in Europe right now is over 200,000 refugees and where they should go. Turkey's handling 10 times of that on its own with little international assistance. So it's done really well. But I think where Turkey's unprepared and caught, therefore, by the fallout of Syria is how those issues in Syria are boomeranging into Turkey. One of that is, as you discussed, the Kurdish issue. I think part of the reason the PKK has vigor in fighting inside Turkey is because it's found energy coming from PYD, not necessarily weapons and personnel, but energy coming from PYD's success in establishing a territorial base, cantons, and a hold onto Syrian territory, which is a model that PKK now wants to replicate inside Turkey. It's not a coincidence that the PKK now wants to set, as they call it, as they're called in Syria as well, cantons inside Syria, Turkey, because that's also worked inside Syria. So unexpectedly, I think that's one area where that issue is coming in. The other area issues, I think, that are making their way into Turkish politics, and I hope that Turkey does a really good job of preventing them from becoming mainstay. One of them is the entry of Russia into Turkish domestic politics. Again, you raised this issue, and as I said, I want to take it one step further. Those of you who are old enough will remember Turkey through a near civil war in the 1970s, in which hard leftists backed by the Soviet Union fought hard rightists, mostly nationalists, but some Islamists, and that ended with the coup of 1980, and it was a near civil war that killed thousands of people. I see some trend lines, I hope that I'm wrong, that you're now seeing a polarization of the country along the lines of left and right, hard left and hard right, issues that you've raised in the fault lines that you've identified, in which Russia is so eager to exploit this fault line. So following the plane incident, API, after the plane incident, Putin's commentary on Turkey was not that he targeted Ankara or Turkey. right? He targeted Erdogan and his family, and knowing that if he did, the half of Turkey that did not vote for Erdogan would, of course, embrace these arguments, and it worked. So I think Russia will increasingly try to mobilize anti-government forces from leftists to secularists to Kurds to Alevis to opposition groups under its fault. I'm not suggesting that this will happen necessarily, but Russia will try. I hope that it fails. But it will try to mobilize this, exploit this fault line, expecting that the deeply polarized nature of Turkish society will allow him to, of course, have a support base inside Turkish politics. Not only Russia, I think ISIS will also try to exploit in finishing, coming at the polarization from another angle, from the other side of the spectrum. And I think ISIS tech in this regard is that so far Turkey had four unfortunate ISIS terror attacks that have killed nearly 200 people and wounded hundreds of others. Whoever is planning ISIS attacks, I think, is very strategic because the attacks have targeted entirely and exclusively opposition rallies. The first three, that is, they targeted Kurds, socialists, leftists, Alevis, and the last attack, which took place in Istanbul, which was, of course, received wider coverage. It's in Turkey's bigger city. Even then, I think the group was strategic. It targeted Istanbul's old city. The old city has a lot of mosques and churches and shops and restaurants, but few Turks. If you blow up a bomb in the old city, you're almost sure that you're going to kill more foreigners than Turks, and in this case, all were foreigners and tourists, and I think this is definitely calculated. The group is trying to create the image that it's not really interested in hurting this half of Turkey. It's only interested in hurting the other half of Turkey, and I could see this in the media reactions to the ISIS attack, where grief was not universal, unfortunately, as was the case after the Ankara attack. You didn't see an outpouring of sympathy for the victims. Rather, it was a polarized sympathy of victims, depending on which side of the spectrum you were at. So I think those are some of the unexpected challenges, ISIS, Russia, and the broader fallout of the Syrian conflict and the way it's getting important to Turkey. These are some of the unexpected challenges that Turkey's foreign policy is now, through which Turkey's foreign policy is shaping Turkey's domestic politics. And I think you've done an excellent job in bringing these up for us because most of us, including myself, not necessarily my colleagues, we focus on how domestic politics drives foreign policy, and I think that's much easier to do than, of course, doing the other way around, looking at how foreign policy shapes domestic politics. So looking into the future, I hope, of course, that Turkey's rise continues. That's obviously an aspiration for the country. But at the same time, I think Turkey has a number of very serious challenges ahead of it, and I think the most significant, I would say, is Russia. Obviously, this is a country which is Turkey's historic nemesis. It's Turks and Russians fought 17 or even 13 campaigns against each other from 1470s when they became neighbors until the end of the Russian Empire in 1917 with the Bolshevik Revolution. The Ottomans and Russians became neighbors in 1470s when the Crimean Khanate joined the Ottoman Empire as part of a commonwealth. Crimean Tatars, that is. So when Putin invaded Ukraine and Crimea and said he should go back to Russia because it's Russian, I wanted to say, well, it's really Tatar. So anyhow. But that neighborhood brought the countries together. 17 times they fought. Guess who started all these wars? Russia. And guess who lost all of them? Turkey. So obviously that's why I think the post-plane incident is really a different landscape in Turkish foreign policy. And the good takeaway of it is that it will inevitably align Turkey closer with the U.S. Western alliance, including NATO. There's even an angle for the EU here, which I'm happy to look at the Q&A, as Nora has touched as well. But thank you again. Yeah.
Thanks, Soner. As always, this is brilliant, but you managed to speak more than Nora did. You know? Okay. So, Alan, please. I know you're full of Udumi. All right, I'll do that. It's yours.
Anyway, I will try to keep it brief, and maybe I can almost sum it up in two words. Gee whiz, that's a great job. You're not getting the... You want me to move this up? Got it? Okay, great. So I think most of you... My voice tends to carry, I think most of you heard my initial comments. It's a terrific piece,
Kamal used the term rich and nuanced, and I think that says it very well. It's pretty remarkable in 14 pages. I think you did a masterful job of showing what the AK period has been all about, how it has changed, and particularly the interplay with the U.S. and the West and the Middle East. If I were recommending to a policymaker who's new to Turkey, this happens all the time. People who are new to Turkey become policymakers on Turkey in our system. I can't think of a better piece than this to give them for a quick, concise read. And I would say, read it tonight, no matter what, whether you're tired or not tired. It's a great read. And that's, you know, I'm afraid I have only more compliments here. It is, I think it's beautifully written. I have to say, you have an enviable way of really finding the right nuance for describing things. In addition, sometimes it almost reaches to the poetic, and I have to quote a very alliterative phrase here from page 5. The personalization of power and the projection of partisan preferences. I thought that was a very nice touch. But look, primarily it's very insightful. And before getting into some of the specifics, I also just wanted to call attention to the fact that I think your experience in Turkey really shines through. You know, I know a lot of us do political analysis based on what happened yesterday and what might happen tomorrow, but I think this paper is not only about the AK Party years, but really contains some deeper insights about Turkish politics, and I'll just cite one on page 12, I think it is, where you talk about why it's difficult for Turkish politicians to back down. And that's something that's more general and goes well beyond the AK Party years. I think the use of the term populism is very apt, including in foreign policy, where it was clear, particularly when Mr. Davutoglu became foreign minister, that Turkey really saw the Middle Eastern street, particularly the Arab street, as on its side. And so populism wasn't only a domestic factor, as you point out, but it was a foreign policy factor. Sadly, I think Turkey has emerged in recent years, has moved from being a country where foreign policy was very much based on institutions once upon a time. Foreign ministry, and as you point out, the military having been the most dominant for many decades up until the past decade. It's become now very much a foreign policy that is at the whim of one person, very much in the Middle Eastern tradition. And that is an unfortunate development. To use the Syria policy as an example, there's never been much support in Turkey for intervention in Syria. But Erdogan has continued to pursue that policy. No doubt Davutoglu was the mastermind, but it's Erdogan's policy, and now he has he's really embraced it. And I don't think there's really anybody in Turkey whose word countermands Erdogan's. A year and a half ago at the UNGA, at the UN General Assembly meeting, a meeting was scheduled between the Turkish foreign minister and the Egyptian foreign minister. Erdogan, without letting anyone know, apparently on his own team, gave a speech in which he ripped into General Sisi, causing the Egyptians to cancel the meeting. So that was certainly a clear example where Erdogan was acting on his own. He is the dominant player in all aspects of Turkey. In Turkey, populism, I think, inevitably means religion. It's 99% Muslim. And Erdogan has, and you bring this out, I think could even be brought out a bit more, that part of Erdogan's populism is a religious vision. He's talked about, particularly in the educational realm, but I think it, you can extrapolate from it, that his goal is to develop a pious generation, dindar nesil in Turkish, religious generation, pious generation. And we've seen that in, his, in legislation, which has led to expansion of the religious school system, expansion of the Religious Affairs Bureau he has done. There's been, I think, particularly at the local level, seen pressure so that it's very difficult for women who don't cover their heads to get jobs in many localities. It's very difficult to have a nice cold one because pressure is put on local restaurateurs not to serve booze. That, I think, is part of his populist vision, but I think it's largely of a popular vision in Turkey, which in many ways is a religious country. And that's how the party pulls down 50% of the vote, as it has done in two of the last three elections. It's not the only way, but it's a significant element. Nora, you talk about Turkey, how the U.S. promoted Turkey as a role model. And I think you really nail that, how the elements that caused that to change, particularly Gezi Park and particularly Turkey's alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, at one point, the U.S. thought, I believe, U.S. policymakers thought the Muslim Brotherhood was indeed the wave of the future and that Erdogan would be a good horse to ride into that future. But that idea went sour with the demise of the Morsi government in Egypt, the fall of Ennahda in Tunisia, and the disaster in Syria. Erdogan stayed on the Muslim Brotherhood hobby horse, where even as the U.S. and his allies soured on it. A lot of points to mention. Look, you in your recommendation section, and this maybe was where I would go a little further than you, you make some good recommendations, and which you've reiterated here, about building bridges on specific area on areas of specific interest, and then longer term working with civil society to build up a long-term investment. I think that's and long-term mutual interest. I think that's all terrific. I agree with all of that. But I think one area where I would have to fault U.S. policy somewhat is I feel we could be speaking out and should be speaking out more strongly on human rights issues. This is a very dark time in Turkey on human rights. Three editors-in-chief are either in jail or under indictment. Countless journalists have been fired. It's all anecdotal, but it's widespread anecdotal that, you know, there's a tremendous amount of self-censorship out of fear that goes on in Turkish newsrooms and editorial boards. And I think one of the most appalling things in Turkey relative to the amount of attention it gets is the number of cases of people who have been arrested or fined for insulting the president. That is a real law in Turkey, Article 299. But it's not one that has been so frequently invoked in the past as it has been under Erdogan. I'm taking these numbers from an NGO, but it sounds right to me, just impressionistically. Two presidents ago, President Caesar invoked this law 26 times. Seems like 26 times too much to me, but nevertheless, relatively, you'll see, it wasn't so much. Abdullah Gül, who was Turkey's first Islam-oriented president, but it's always seen as very moderate, invoked it 139 times. Erdogan, who became president in August 2014, has invoked it over 1,300 times. I mean, it's hard to reconcile insulting the president, particularly the president who's so political, with democratic practice. I wonder how many cases Barack Obama could bring for them. anyway, I think it's something we really need to speak out on more. Vice President Biden, I think, did try to do that in his recent trip to Turkey. When President Obama was in Turkey for the G20 last year, he did not. When he met with Erdogan in Paris again, he did not. I think one thing is so near underscored since the since we're in API after the plane incident, since November 24th, when Turkey shot down the Russian Su-24, I don't think the United States needs to worry that strong talk about human rights will lead Turkey to expel us from Incirlik. In wartime, protecting our guys and winning the war always comes first. And yes, it's critical that we use Incirlik and the other installations that the Turks let us use. But I think right now it's clear that Turkey needs the United States, needs the Western Alliance, needs NATO. And the clash with Russia, I think, is something that's very, very worrisome and we need to talk about more. I'll just say I think you probably agree with most of these points on human rights. I'm just underscoring them, and I know it's my time, so I'm going to wrap up here and just say mabruk to Brigadierum on a sorry, wrong language, on a really terrific paper.
Thanks, Alan. I really wish we had more time and you could all expand a bit more. But you beat Soner, definitely.
Good job.
No problem. I'm keeping an eye on there. And my concern is really to protect the rights of our audience here, too. And I'm sure that Kadir is going to make an effort in that direction. But don't feel obliged that you have to compliment Nora to the extent that Soner and Alan have
he
done.
He did it, not me. Well, congratulations on the paper. It really, thank you for the invitation, Kemal Hocam. I think it really focuses on a very important topic. It can appear abstract somehow and maybe not, you know, it does reference various policy instances, various issues, Russia, Syria, Kurdish issue, and then tries to give it a sort of theoretical framework. But I think it's very relevant, this, the relationship between populism and foreign policy in the case of Turkey, because part of it, of course, I'm going to have to now play the devil's advocate here, but part of it, a lot of things that have been written in recent months and a couple of years, during the Arab Spring especially, I think there's been an overemphasis on the rhetoric of Turkish leaders, and I sense that in the paper as well. Somehow, A Turkish leader, more specifically President Erdogan, says this, says X, and then Turkey does the Y the next day. So I think that's a bit overemphasized, and this is not just for the paper, but in general, a lot of the editorials and op-eds we read these days have that. And I think populism, as you pointed out as well, exists everywhere, and there is a dynamic interplay between populism and domestic political considerations, but also foreign policy. But in the paper, the figures cited are Chavez and Le Pen and Trump and Putin. Somehow populism appears to be necessarily and consistently a negative fact, political reality. We have varying degrees of that. The opposition in Turkey does it, opposition in this country does it, President Obama, everybody does it at a certain level. But the question you raise is important. How much that really determines, defines foreign policy actions, policies themselves. So I would raise a question on that. In the case of Turkey, the picture appears a bit recurrently. Okay, President Erdogan, as rhetoric somehow are policy itself. So I think we do need to make a distinction and see how what is being done on the ground. We can actually, in all the examples you gave, Russia, Syria, others, I have comments on them, we need to sort of subject those issues to that test. Where does populism start? How does it translate to specific policy step that the leadership took, and how that damaged Turkish interests? I think that needs to be done a bit more thoroughly, case by case. And I would take issue also with the dichotomy between anti-Western rhetoric and pro-Western realism. I think that's a bit of a problematic, because Turkish politics in general has had an undertone of suspicion against Europe, suspicion against the West, ever since the First World War, if not before. And then, on the other hand, Turkey's aspirations to become a fully European developed, westernized country has existed all along. Those two existed since the establishment of the Republic, and you can go even beyond that. And if we are able to call Turkey some predictable ally during the Cold War, for instance, that means that that doesn't mean during Cold War Turkey did not have an anti-Western attitude while also having a staunchly pro-Western foreign policy. In this specific example of the downing of the Russian jet, as I said, I don't see where populism starts and ends in this example. Actually, Turkey had very strong relations with Russia before the incident, and after the incident, before the incident or after the incident, we didn't see President Erdogan use strong language against Russia. He sought reconciliation, and that continues to today. So, maybe you can respond to that, where you see the specific instance of populism, and then that, yes, you do mention that Putin and Erdogan, they want to become regional kingmakers. That's the expression you use. But they also managed to have their economic and energy relationship going while disagreeing on Syria. So how did this instance really fit into the picture of, you know, the interplay between populism and foreign policy? In the EU era section, I thought that your treatment of the military tutelage, it was almost like we had a strongly pro-Western institutional memory that was sort of that was with clever plan of the Turkish leadership, was kind of dissected, or, you know, it was sidelined, and that was with the help of the EU. And in the picture that comes out of that, it's not only in the paper. I'm also talking about broader debates that we've been having. In that picture, Erdogan seems to be able to kind of trick the EU to help him come overcome the military. And that downplays the fact that in 2007 we had a presidential crisis. Erdogan could not run for the highest office. Erdogan couldn't run.
Oh, yeah, true. Yeah.
Gül ran because Erdogan couldn't run. In 2008, we had a closure case. And in those instances, Erdogan went back to the ballot box. I think there's a bit of an underestimation of the power of that establishment, the tutelage regime, continuing well into even our day in many ways. And when you talk about that establishment being pro-Western, they actually openly disagreed with the EU about civilian control of the military. They said, you know, if that means being European and Western, we are actually not so interested. So that was also part of the debate between the leadership and the military. And again, there we need to be favoring civilian control, right? It used to be that the military and foreign ministry defined foreign policy, but that's not necessarily a positive thing, right? So maybe you can clarify that. In the neo-autonomism argument, it seems sort of Turkey got EU's help and AK Party got EU's help and overcame the military. And then once it was done with the EU, it sought other paths. But I think one of the most critical turning points in Turkish foreign policy in the past decade or a bit more is 2003, when Turkey didn't allow the U.S. U.S. military to use Turkish territory for the invasion, and the consequences afterwards. And that decision, I think, forced Turkey to devise its foreign policy on its own, arguably, in many ways, for the first time, right? It's not simple anymore. We can't simply say yes to America, yes, whatever. There was also anti-invasion feeling in Europe, but that was a moment that things were not simple anymore. Turkey had lost in the first Iraq war with the spike of violence, PKK violence in its southeast. So this time, it wasn't going to just simply go along with what the West wanted, but it also was willing to make some sort of deal. It didn't work out, and Turkish parliament said no. I would say that somehow we need to include that if you're talking about Turkish foreign policy, specifically AK Party's foreign policy, 2003 is very critical. With respect to Israel, 2008, I'm coming to
the end. I'm trying to lean on
yes. If we are going to talk about populist rhetoric by the Turkish leadership, I would say it only started after the Gaza War of 2008 and 2009. Right before then, Turkey was still trying to broker a deal between Syria and Israel, and you didn't hear Erdogan, saying negative things about Israel in public, the way that it happened afterwards. And then even after the fallout of Mavi Marmara, economic relations remained and even strengthened. So I would just say that bad relations between Turkey and Israel was not simply the result of Turkish populism in that sense. In the case of Syria, again, we have this idea that Erdogan somehow got mad at Assad, Turkey ditched its relationship with Syria and then pushed for a regime change in Syria. And there you go, you have your sort of populism resulting in a disaster. And I think the picture is much more complicated than the refugee flows that were already starting to appear, border security issues, as well as the economic relations with Syria, but also the broader Middle East. Those were also, and then Turkey saw it coming at that time, talked about the potential terrorism, Assad becoming just like the Libyan leader Gaddafi, etc. Anyway, my point is also PKK, PYD's activities in Syria, those were real interests that drove Turkey's decisions at that point. I don't think it was heavily dominated by populism. Lastly, maybe on the Kurdish peace process, I don't think it's dead despite the fighting right now. In some ways, these peace processes take a long time, and then you may not have a final outcome, but they take a long time, and you often have fighting and negotiations back and forth over a long period of time. But what we saw in this case also, that the process was hampered by regional developments that gave PKK a lot of incentives, both in Syria and in terms of getting itself legitimized in the international arena by fighting ISIS. Those were real interests for PKK. So peace with Turkey was not that interesting at that point. And then they wanted to wait and see if AK Party would survive over the electoral process. So I think here, populism, I'm not denying populism is not a driver. I definitely agree it is one of the drivers. But I think it is kind of crowned upon the security interests, socioeconomic realities, as well as strategic considerations. And I don't think it's just because Erdogan said so, Turkey does this. So that's my only sort of big argument with it. But it's congratulations for the paper.
Thanks a lot, Karim. I think you did a great job in raising a series of questions and playing the devil's advocate, but at some price. Nora, I think the way we're going to have to proceed is you have to allow me to turn to the floor and then maybe respond to some of the comments and especially the questions that Kadir has raised. So, yes, sir. Yes, sir. I think you're going to get a micro, yeah. Please mention your name, too. And
My name is Robert Cooper.
Yes, sir.
My wife is Turkish, and I'm interested in what the panel thinks the role and impact of HDP in their new position in Parliament will be in the upcoming debates over amending the Constitution.
Thank you. Rafi, I think I saw you. Yes, Warren. First Rafi and then. I'll take four.
Thank you. I'm Rafi Danziger. I'm now a consultant to APAC, so naturally my question is about Israel. And there's been a change recently in Erdogan's rhetoric and policy toward Israel. Maybe Nora wrote about it. I haven't had yet the pleasure of reading your paper. But there's been a change, especially since Erdogan said that Turkey and Israel need each other. It was totally unexpected, I think. Is it part of what Elam was talking about, Turkey turning more to NATO, that's part of in the West? Is it energy? What is it an API? What exactly explains what seems to be the beginning of a possible shift toward Israel? Thank you.
Gift from Putin, I think. Warren, and then in the back. I'll come for another quick round, Matteo. Here in the front. Warren, yeah.
Wayne Mary, the American Foreign Policy Council. Forgive me, but I'm going to introduce the subject of Cyprus, which has not been raised. At the moment, the correlation of forces on that island is as positive as at any point in my lifetime. It's an extraordinary set of developments, to the extent that I think it now may rest entirely in the hands of President Erdogan. What will he do?
All right. Thanks, Wayne. You know, looking at the clock, I have a feeling that the best way to go is to take Matteo, and there was one more question in the back. Yes, there. And then we'll proceed.
Sorry. It's not Matteo, it's Alar.
Alar, yeah.
It's okay, come on. It's been a long day.
You look very different, actually.
Alar Olim, I'm visiting fellow from the European Union at Brookings. Congratulations. I actually read your paper over lunch. Very good analysis. I concur completely with the panelists. I was just wondering, though, about this connection between populism and foreign policy. I think I would side more with the last speaker, that the tie is not so direct and it's a little bit less obvious, especially looking at the record of the AKP over the last few years. I mean, if you look at some of the main foreign policy directions, there have been some amazing turnarounds. I mean, one aspect of the policy in the beginning was this no problems foreign policy, where they had a rapprochement with Syria, with Iran. If you look at where we are now with Syria and Iran, it's a complete about turn. As we just heard from one of the commenters, Israel as well. Now you see a very interesting turnaround taking place, perhaps also spurred by the threat of a cutoff of Russian gas. Who knows? But my question would be regarding another possible turnaround, which we haven't really seen, let's say, digested in Turkish politics, but certainly has been very apparent. Just today there was an announcement from Brussels about a new deal with Turkey, between the EU and Turkey. We saw a kind of an estrangement between Turkey and the European Union because of the slowdown of the accession process, and also partly because of the Turkish growth, and Turkey felt more independent, didn't need Europe anymore. Can we predict, and I would ask you and the other panelists also, that now with the European Union suddenly finding that Turkey is a useful ally on the issue of migration, and Turkey also looking for new friends and you know, seeing itself being confronted by a newly resurgent Russia in the neighborhood, can we see some return? I think this would be the most positive inference, a return to the EU reform path, in order to really bolster the accession process, which is supposed to be one of the parts of the package with the EU. Thank you.
I wish that question was directed to me. But Steve, very quickly, please.
Yeah. Steve Larrabee Rand. I'd like to congratulate you on a...
I think the micro is not on, you know.
On a very fine paper.
Still not working.
But I have the same problem that I don't think anyone attribute.
Steve, can you try the other microbes? It's still not working.
I don't think you can
attribute
any of the main themes of Turkish foreign policy to populism. Populism has not been a driver of, let's say, Turkish policy towards the EU. It's not been a driver of Turkish policy and recent problems with Russia. It's not been a driver of U.S. policy. So that's the basic problem. And quite frankly, it is not a major driver, in my view, of policy, of domestic politics. Erdogan's presidential ambitions and his strategy is not driven by populism. So, therefore, I think the paper, the main thesis is, I think, not really substantiating some of the suggestions you make.
Thank you.
All right, Steve, that was a bit harsh, I thought. We'll survive it. Nora, I think we'll start with you, but, you know, we have literally 12 minutes.
Yeah.
So and then we'll go in the reverse order.
Sure. So, I mean, I think I'll take up the last point, the last 2 points that have been raised that also map on nicely to what Katharine Bay raised. I mean, I think I fundamentally disagree that populism has not had an impact and has not been a driver of domestic politics. And if the paper underspecifies the mechanism by which that translates into foreign policy, I think in, you know, if we had more time, but I'm also happy to, you know, write a follow-up paper specifying the way that it has domestic political impact, which plays into foreign policy priorities and position staking in ways that have manifestly affected the EU accession process, that have manifestly affected regional policy towards the transnational Kurdish question and towards Syria more broadly and towards the Muslim Brotherhood, as was alluded to earlier, and that have had a problematic impact on bilateral relations with the United States. You know, I'm sympathetic to say to the argument that okay, well, let's look at what Turkey does rather than what Turkey says. But then why say those things in the first place if you're acting in a patently pro-Western fashion that is, you know, serving mutual interests? So if there is a dissonance, if there is a disconnect between the populist rhetoric and the foreign policy imperatives, the responsibility for that lies with those who are articulating those positions. And so in that regard, I mean, when it comes to some of the specific issues we can look at more, I think at the end of the day, though, the dilemma that we're faced with, and that maybe all of us can, this could be the takeaway as we leave the room, is to what extent is this sort of new set of structural sort of geopolitical concerns that have been raised vis-a-vis the Kurdish question, vis-a-vis Cyprus, vis-a-vis rapprochement with the EU, so the various topics that have been brought up by the audience and also by the panelists, the you know, post-airline incident?
After API.
API, yeah. So in the API era, how much will this structural imperative towards repivoting towards the West, towards consolidating Turkey's Western relationships, how much will this indeed drown out the tenor of populism? I very much hope it does. I would love for Stephen Larrabee to be right and for populism to prove irrelevant and for bilateral relations and relations with the West to, you know, to prove enduring and revitalized by this new set of geopolitical challenges that we see in the fight against ISIS, that we see in the refugee crisis, very much relevant to the EU. But I think the onus is on Turkey's leadership to put their money where their mouth is.
All right. Thanks, Nora. I mean, we're all dealing with substances when we're looking at, it's very difficult to establish that causal relationship. So this kind of debate could go on forever. And it's done it in the past. It will keep going on. Kadir, let me turn to you. And if you might be able to address Wayne's, especially Cyprus, maybe Israel and the HDP there very quickly.
In terms of going back to the pro-Western outlook, assumes Turkey left that outlook. So that's a problem, but I don't see a Western position on Syria, for instance, that we can say Turkey is not aligning with it, so it's not pro-Western. And we have many disagreements within the EU about itself. Forget about what its policy going to be on Syria, but its own identity internally, UK wanting to leave, etc. So that we need to think about more. I think the Cyprus, Turkey, Israel, I think those might be actually, this is my speculation, that might be a package deal. I mean, you need you need Cyprus for a better relationship with the EU, and EU needs you for refugees, and then you need energy, and Israel has energy, and Israel is threatening to bypass you, so maybe, you know, so this actually is an example of how Turkey is considering these things and, if necessary, making these changes, and sometimes rather abruptly. And it's not a done deal. But I think Turkey has prepared some sort of, you know, it's reconciliation with Israel. They've been talking for a long time, and it seems they have some sort of blueprint. But when it's going to happen and how it's going to benefit both sides, that's going to be a matter of timing and strategic timing in that sense. So let me just leave there.
Yes, Nora.
And I think that that will be a wonderful litmus test. If Turkey and Israel are able to move forward with this rapprochement, I think it would do wonders towards sustaining the argument that you've been making, that Turkey's policies have always been oriented in the right direction, and we shouldn't be distracted by the theatrics.
Thanks, Nora. Alan, I know you have a lot of experience, background. Maybe you could reflect on, I'm very interested in Wayne's question too. Is this one going to be the real one?
Cyprus. Can I go down them all quickly? And
all right. I have no authority.
Let me just.
You're a nice guy.
Cut me off in 3 minutes.
But that thing there has authority.
Yeah, cut me off in 3 minutes. We got HDP. I think they can do precious little when there is violence going on. I think, sadly, we're seeing the support for HDP also eroding, both on the Kurdish and the Turkish side. It's a party that would thrive in peacetime, and I think it would have had Erdogan pursued the peace process instead of junking his own creative policy. Israel, I agree with Nora. This is really one of the litmus tests, anyway, of whether AKP is pursuing a populist policy or not. I think the Israel policy has been very populist-oriented. Why the change? Yes, it's the isolation and the potential need for energy in the wake of the shoot-down of the Russian plane, API. Whether Israel is interested, and whether some of the parties that Israel has crucial relationships with in the region, like Egypt and Russia, which is now right smack in Israel's region, Cyprus and Greece, with which Israel has productive relations, whether they will advise Israel on how they feel about it, I think that could be telling in terms of how Israel looks at it. Cyprus, I think Erdogan will not be the obstacle to a Cyprus solution. I'm not sure. I agree with you. I've also been following Cyprus a long time. And this is one of the most optimistic times, but I'm not sure we're quite there yet, or that we're going to get there in 2016. But I do not think Erdogan will be the obstacle. I think he'll score points. If everything is lined up and it meets all the tests and he's not selling, he's not appearing to sell out the Turkish Cypriots, as was the case in 2004 also, he supported the referendum. I think he would do it again. He would score points back here. Just say on the Turkish EU question, I think there's still a lot of questions on what the EU has offered. I'll be very surprised if Turks really get visa-free access to the European Union, as was promised. On opening some of the chapters, Cyprus is going to have a say too. They'd like access to Turkish ports first, as you know. I'll stop there.
Well, thanks. Alan, though I can't help say one quick word on Cyprus. I'm not sure that it all depends on what position Erdogan takes in terms of an output.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I'm wondering, I know he has a lot on his plate, Putin, but I wonder if he may have tentacles and ways
of... I'm just saying if it gets to Erdogan's desk, yes or no, he'll check the yes.
Thank you. Soner.
Let me also start with Cyprus. I think that stars look aligned. Turkey needs Israeli gas. Turkey wants to normalize. Israel wants to normalize. Maybe that will happen. Resolution of the Cyprus issue will bring Turkey-Greece together, eliminate the major roadblock out of Turkey's EU accession. So while stars are aligned, I think if you find out in a year that deal hasn't happened, I know that we won't be able to find fingerprints, but the culprit is going to be Russia. How it does it? It's, of course, Russian foreign policy is usually through instruments of deniability, asymmetrical versions of foreign policy instruments, as well as unconventional stuff. So hard for me to see what they'll do, but I think Russia has a deep interest in making sure that this deal does not happen, because it will eliminate Turkey's energy dependency on Russia. It will also eliminate the need for Russia to be an actor, as well as, you know, bringing Turkey and NATO and the Western alliance closer together. On Israel also, I want to weigh in. I agree with you guys that this will be a litmus test of Turkey's commitment to a realistic foreign policy, and one that's not ideological or populist. I'm less upbeat, so we'll see if that happens or not. I'll believe it when I see it. But I hope it does, because I think it will serve as Turkey's coming to maturity as a foreign policy actor. I am more upbeat on Turkey's, as Nora calls it, great Western calibration on regional policy with U.S. and NATO, somehow agnostic on Israel, and less upbeat on a great recalibration with the EU. Although I'm a strong proponent of Turkey's EU accession, I think that the dynamics will not really shift that relationship compared to what we have today. For one reason, Erdogan's commitment to liberal democracy, as Alan mentioned, I agree with you on that. I think that's, of course, a sine qua non for EU entry in the long term. But even in the short term, what I think will undermine the Turkish-EU relationship from going what it is, a transactional one, to what it could become, a strategic one, is that the refugee issue is going to be a big issue of 2016. Putin has zero interest in solving the refugee crisis, because this is how we make sure that Turkey fights Greece, Greece fights Macedonia, Macedonia fights Serbia, Serbia fights Austria, Greece, Denmark, Sweden, all the way up. It's a way of undermining Europe's integrity, stability, both NATO and the EU. So most of the refugees coming from Syria are coming from government-controlled areas. They're bombed by Russia. So obviously there's a direct correlation between Russian bombing and flow of refugees, and expect more of them, unfortunately, to flow out. Finally, on the broader debate, I agree with Nora. I think you're really to the point in making an argument that this is populist, as Alan put it, religion or ideology-driven foreign policy, which is at times out of touch with reality. I think at its core, to be fair, Turkey's foreign policy is not ideological, it's idealistic. It really wants to do good. Now, part of that, as I said earlier, is imagined, because it wants to bring in Ottoman benevolence, meaning if the Ottomans could come back, everything would go back to running well, and it doesn't always work like that. I think if you are familiar with Arab historiography, it's not much different than Balkan historiography, meaning a generation of Arabs grew up learning that Turks were colonial overlords, as did Serbs and Greeks. So Turkey coming back to the region has not and will not be a welcome factor, and I think in that regard, the Ottoman benevolence is the part of foreign policy where it's out of touch with reality. But the bigger part is that it's at its core idealistic. It wants to do good. It really does. And at times it's ideological, meaning it's partisan. It supports Muslim Brotherhood or Hamas. But it still thinks that it's idealistic. Mm-hmm. So its support for the rebels in Syria, its support for Hamas in the Palestinian theater, is seen as support for doing good, not seen as support for a partisan good. And I think it's that confusion that keeps Turkish foreign policy down. So in Syria, for example, Assad is a dictator. I think he should go to the war crimes tribunal, and he's a horrible guy. But Turkey's foreign policy in Syria is still saying Turkey is with the Syrian people. About a third of Syrian people are supporting Assad for whatever reason, however he built that majority. And I think because Turkey's still in that idealistic thinking of the region, it's unable to come to terms and say, Maybe my line has been partisan because I have supported certain groups in Syria and not others, and therefore I am a side to a conflict, but not necessarily a broader kingmaker in Syrian politics. So I think to the extent that it continues to be idealistic and taking ideological stance for idealism, Turkish foreign policy will continue to come to a short ends where it realizes that it's not able to make Turkey a great regional power.
Thanks, Soner. I've just been under pressure for one Soner, more sentence here.
I just wanted to say it could be perceived as ideological and idealist, but that doesn't mean it doesn't serve Turkey's interests. So I think it's a matter of gauging where it ends and where it starts. And then those interests, the investments you make, can turn out to be junk bonds at the end. But every country, every power does that.
Mm-hmm. Can I have 10 seconds? I'll disagree. Just 10 seconds. Look, four of the five biggest terror attacks in Turkey's history have taken place in the last 3 years, and they're all connected to the fallout of the Syrian war. How is that in the interest of Turkey? I'm sorry.
Good. Nine seconds, you managed it. I'd like to thank the panel, every member of it, Nora, and I am hoping that your baby will grow into a world where Turkey is boring. Thanks to you all.